It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Donald Trump's resounding and unexpected victory was fueled in part by strong support in rural America, including here in Iowa. While campaigning, Trump didn't talk much about farm policy, and he doesn't have a record on agriculture policy. However, he has pledged to keep the farm bill together, invest in infrastructure, slash regulations, and renegotiate trade deals. Joining us this first half hour to talk about his nearly 8 years as U.S. Secretary of Agriculture and what he sees coming under the Trump administration, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, also, of course, former governor of Iowa. Secretary Vilsack, how nice of you to join us. Thank you.
Well, Ben, it's been a great opportunity to visit with you in the past, and I look forward to this opportunity today.
Start us off by telling us, what are your biggest concerns about ag policy under a Trump administration?
Well, I think there's a recognition that trade is critically important to American agriculture. 30% of all sales, 20% of all ag income, farm income is related directly to exports. Our number one and three trading partners for ag exports are China and Mexico. And clearly, there are some deep concerns on the part of what our relationship will be relative to China and Mexico generally, and how that may potentially impact agricultural exports. And that, of course, would significantly impact and affect farm income and rural communities. So that would be my major concern. I sincerely hope that we maintain a strong relationship with those two countries, because we sell a lot of what's grown, particularly in Iowa, to both of those countries.
Mm-hmm. President-elect Trump says he plans to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, as we call it, to make it, in his words, a lot better for U.S. workers. He's pledged to leave NAFTA if it can't be improved to his liking. This has been in place over 20 years. How might the renegotiation of NAFTA impact Iowa's economy?
Well, I'm obviously not quite privy to precisely what he wants to do with reference to NAFTA. Let me just simply say that we've been working with Mexico and Canada over the course of the last several years to ease restrictions to make it easier, for example, to move product across the borders, which obviously has an impact, a positive impact on agriculture, since we have generally, with the rest of the world, a trade surplus in agriculture. In other words, we sell more agricultural products than we purchase from the rest of the world, and that helps to support jobs here in the United States. The reality is that every $1 billion of ag sales supports somewhere between 6,000 and 6,500 jobs. So, if there's anything that's done in a negotiation or renegotiation or in a relationship that impacts and affects making it more difficult, creating more friction at the border, or that results in us having to reinstitute certain protective measures that in turn are reciprocated by other countries, part of what they will do is that they will hurt the area where we have the greatest advantage, which is in agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, it seems NAFTA and other trade deals have been lightning rods for voter anger, especially in the American heartland this year. Do you acknowledge this voter anger? Have these trade deals been misinterpreted, or do the voters have a real gripe here?
Well, I think there's I think this underscores a larger problem, which is that government and those of us who work in government have probably not done as good a job as we need to do in explaining to folks precisely what is being done through government and by government to help people. That's certainly true, I think, in the trade area. Farmers understand the importance of trade. That's why they have been supportive of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. That's why they have encouraged more trade opportunities around the world. They see this and they understand it at their level. We perhaps have not done as good a job as we need to do to explain to workers whose lives are impacted by trade, where they may not be even aware of the fact that their supply chain is part of a global trading system. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to do a better job of explaining the benefits, and I think we need to do a better job of explaining what government does. When I travel around the country, I've been to all 50 states, and when I come to a state like Iowa, I make sure that I explain to folks how much money has been invested in their future in partnership with them to rebuild or revitalize or to spur economic opportunity. Iowans might be surprised, for example, to note that this department has invested in the last 8 years nearly $30 billion in the state. Now, that's just one department. We've helped to finance homes. We've helped to start businesses. We've helped to expand conservation efforts. There's been a substantial amount of resource invested by one federal department, and I suspect that very few Iowans are fully aware of that. We've made an effort to try to better educate people, and hopefully that will continue in the future.
So you're saying, the way I interpret what you're saying, it's been purely a problem of messaging, not the design of the trade deals or ag policy. That you're saying it's just messaging, a problem, not the design of these policies.
There's a difference between discussing about trade, which is a component, but by no means all of globalization. I think what people are really deeply concerned about is the impact that globalization and technology have had on changing the nature of work that's being done in the U.S. And what we have also failed to do as a people and as a government at every level is to identify the transitioning industries and preparing people for that transition, better preparing them for new opportunities. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
What's all abuzz now are driverless cars. You know, we've got folks working on cars that will not require a driver, that in theory will be safer because computers will basically determine risk and avoid them. Now, everyone gets excited about that prospect, but what I think of when I think of that is I think, well, what are we going to do with bus drivers? What are we going to do with taxi cab drivers? I was a taxi cab driver at one point. And I think about the impact it's going to have potentially on people who have made a living, on truckers, making a living driving a vehicle. And so we have to basically, if that's the direction that we want as a country to get to safer motor vehicle transportation, then we have better have a plan for all those people whose lives will be impacted and affected negatively by that transition. We've not done a particularly good job of that, and I think that's where the frustration is. People see an industry going out of business or contracting, and they don't see the companion opportunity that's being created. What we've tried to do in the time I've been in secretary here is to say to rural America, we've got a strategy to rebuild the rural economy that's based not just on production, agriculture, and exports, but local and regional food systems, conservation, and the bio-based manufacturing economy. And we've seen the results of the investments we've made in a declining unemployment rate and a declining poverty rate. So we need to do more of that.
During the election, candidate Donald Trump campaigned on the notion he would eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency, eliminate regulations he feels are a burden on family farms. I wonder, and I've talked with farmers as well, and that seems to be a theme, that there are perhaps unnecessary regulations out there. Is that the way you interpret these election results, that in some cases there's been overregulation of Iowa agriculture, farmers?
Well, I think the regulations that, again, this is an it starts with an education component. The EPA doesn't just sit in the folks at the EPA doesn't sit in their office trying to figure out how to overregulate individuals. They are being directed by acts of Congress or by federal judges directing them to take certain action. Most of the time when the EPA promulgates a rule, it's because Congress has directed them to do that or because a federal judge has said you have until a date certain to get it done. I think the challenge for EPA is making sure that there's a clear understanding of the problem they're trying to solve, and a very clear and distinct, succinct understanding of what individuals have to do to comply with the regulation. And I think in the future, there's going to be a lot more emphasis, I would hope, on those two aspects. You know, I think there's clearly a concern in the countryside about the waters of the U.S. rule. And I think part of the concern, maybe not all of it, but part of the concern is not a full understanding of precisely what the rule does or doesn't do. Normal farming activities are not going to be impacted. Having said that, I think it's hard for farmers who have a ditch running through their farmland to know precisely what it is they're supposed to do. And I think there's deep concern that there'll be enforcement that will dramatically and significantly change the way in which they're doing business. And again, I think if the EPA had the time and the staff, they could come down and probably satisfy a substantial percentage of the concerns, maybe not all, but some of the concerns. And I think it's going to be very difficult for a new administration to eliminate the department, since their congressional directions to create the department, this was created during, the Nixon administration, and their federal judges who basically have very deep specific feelings about how that law is to be implemented. But I think, you know, we all have an opportunity here to make sure that if there are regulations, that people understand precisely what the problem is we're trying to solve and why we're trying to solve it and how we're trying to solve it so that they can comply.
If you've just joined us, my guest on this half hour of River to River, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, talking about his nearly 8 years as U.S. Secretary of Agriculture and what he sees coming under the Trump administration. Expand a little bit about your comments about water quality. You've said that Iowa needs to find a solution to water quality concerns. You told the Des Moines Register, we need to think bigger in terms of solutions. So how do we think bigger to address Iowa's water quality concerns? And we have some of the worst water quality in the country.
Well, I think we first of all have to recognize that the problem that we're facing is not a problem that is the responsibility of one and solely one aspect of our economy or of our state. That there are multiple contributors, if you will, to water quality. And that means that there need to be multiple contributors to the solution. In order to solve this, you basically have to look at it one of two ways. There are some states that have aggressively gone after water quality by regulating it, by specifically defining what can and cannot happen.
In a mandatory way, not voluntary.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Mm-hmm. Other states have seen that they have more luck with actual implementation and not people trying to figure out how to game the system or get around the system by creating enough incentives that people are incented to do what's necessary. Given the realities, the political realities in the state of Iowa, I think it's fair to say you're not going to see from the legislature any kind of mandated program. So that means that we have to look at an incentive-driven effort. And I think for that to work, I think the state of Iowa has to be a much bigger player than they've been in the past. I think there has to be a dedicated resource, a substantial resource that is created that creates the financial incentive when combined with the federal incentives, combined with what farmers themselves will put into it, that will create enough of a financial incentive that farmers will be willing to do what's necessary to substantially reduce runoff through conservation practices. It's difficult to ask a farmer to essentially take land out of production or to use it for a different use that may not be as profitable for a benefit to society without some kind of partnership between society and the farmer. And I think that there is an opportunity here for Iowa to set a national standard or example of how an incentive-based system can work. I've seen this work in the Chesapeake Bay area. We now have 99% of the acres involved in that watershed, which is the most unique watershed in the world. 99% of those acres are now involved in some form of conservation. It may be cover crops, it may be no-till, it may be bumper strips, it may be a combination of all those things. And we've seen remarkable improvements in the health of the Chesapeake Bay. More fish, more oysters coming back. And so I know this works, and I'm confident that Iowa can make it work, but you can't make it work if you're going to allocate several million dollars to the problem. This is a problem that's going to require a dedicated resource and a substantial amount of time to see significant improvement, but it can be done. And that when I say think big, I'm talking about a commitment similar to what we did with Vision Iowa, where we essentially created a resource that then leveraged additional investment that helped to fund literally hundreds of projects around the state of Iowa that improved quality of life, that created economic opportunity, that supported job growth while I was governor.
Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, what do you see as the priorities for the next farm bill? Do you see the Trump administration taking a much different approach?
Well, again, I can't speak for the Trump administration, and I don't know that anybody knows precisely what they're going to do with reference to the farm bill. They have not designated who they would like to see be my successor, and they have not been very clear during the course of the campaign of what the farm policy would be. So let me talk about what I see from the implementation of this farm bill and some of the issues that have cropped up that will have to be addressed in one form or another. But before I do that, I would say the most important thing for rural America and for farmers who are interested in making sure a farm bill gets passed is to make sure the conversation starts properly. In the past, the conversation about a farm bill usually starts here in Washington, D.C. with how much money can we save? How much money can we cut out of the programs? When you start the conversation that way, you pit every aspect of this farm bill. And there's a title for energy. There's a title for research. There's a title for forestry. There's a nutrition title. There's a farm safety net title. There's a crop insurance title. There's a rural development title. You pit all conservation title. You pit all of those titles, if you will, all of those interests against one another when you begin the conversation with how much money can we save. It seems to me that a healthier and better discussion about a farm bill would start with what is the need? What is the importance of rural America and what does it need? That then defines the universe of what we need to figure out how to get. And it may be that you get it through a farm bill, you may get it through leverage, you may get it through some creative financing, but you create a much different conversation. So first it has to start with the right conversation. In that conversation, I think what you'll find is that there's a continued need for investment in infrastructure and rural development and job growth in small communities. I think you'll see some commodities who are not satisfied with the way the safety net currently works. I'm thinking of cotton. I'm thinking of the dairy producers. Those folks are not totally satisfied with the way the system set up in the Farm Bill is working. I think you'll see a continued demand for additional resources in the conservation area to be able to create that incentive and that cost share that makes it easier for farmers to do what they want to be able to do with their farm to make sure that it's good stewardship. So I think you'll see a continued effort at the research component of the Farm Bill. The area of probably deepest concern is this issue of whether or not you separate out of the Farm Bill the nutrition programs. And I think there is a misunderstanding and a lack of understanding about the important role that tying nutrition with Farm Bill and farm programs plays. There's less than 1% of America's population that farms. That means 99% don't. We all rely on farmers, but hardly any of us actually farm. And if you look at the people that produce 85% of what we grow, it's really about 0.1%. So in order for a farm bill, in order for farm programs to be supported, you have to get the other 99% interested. Now, how do you do that? Well, one way you can do it is by making sure that people see that there's something in a bill for them. Certainly nutrition assistance impacts and affects many people across rural America, suburban America, and urban America. So you begin to attract support from urban and suburban legislators, members of Congress who have districts that are primarily urban and suburban, based on the nutrition title. They may not have as much of an interest as rural lawmakers may have in the farm bill provisions. So you have this combination that's pretty forceful and can actually get something through the system. If you separate the nutrition provisions on the theory that somehow you're going to save a lot of money and you redirect that money into farm bill programs, farm safety net programs, you're going to find that A, that doesn't work because you're not going to be able to get the farm bill programs through, or B, if it does work, that money is going to be redirected into other priorities. It's not going to go into the farm safety net. So you basically don't get the benefit of what you think you're going to get when you separate, in my view. And the last thing I would say is that farmers need to understand they may like the idea of separating the nutrition from on the theory that they're somehow going to get more resources directed into the programs that they directly care about. The problem is that, if you reduce the amount of resources that people have who are struggling financially to be able to buy food, they'll stop buying the food. And, of course, farmers benefit when more food is purchased and more food is purchased from a grocery store. Everyone in that supply chain benefits. The grocer benefits by having more to sell. The folks who stock the truck, that process, that package, and that grow and produce all of the stuff that's going to the grocery store, they too have more market opportunities and more demand for what they're selling, so they have a healthier market. It helps to stabilize farm prices. So I think people have to be very, very cautious about the separation of nutrition from from the rest of the Farm Bill.
One of the president-elect's main campaign issues, we all know, has been immigration. Senator Jeff Sessions was named to be Trump's attorney general, and he's had a long history of an anti-immigration crusade, raging against illegal immigration and an excess of foreign workers. If undocumented workers are deported, or let's say immigration is severely curtailed, what would that mean for the agriculture industry?
Well, you know, it's funny you should ask that question because I was with a bunch of ag commissioners recently from southern states, primarily southern states, conservative states. And I said, you know, you guys are talking about the EPA, you're talking about the estate tax, but you really ought to be thinking about the impact that potentially could be in rural America if we basically get the Chinese and the Mexicans angry at us, and therefore they're not interested in purchasing agricultural products, and if we don't do immigration reform. Because the workforce that agriculture relies on is predominantly immigrant-based, whether it's the people who pick and harvest and work in the farm fields or whether it's the folks who process the food. And if you think about it, if you destroy markets and you don't have a workforce, it won't make any difference what the regulations are or aren't, and it certainly won't make any difference what the tax rules are because there won't be anything purchased or sold. Markets will shrink. We won't be able to produce as much. Comprehensive immigration reform is about maximizing the potential, in my view, about maximizing the potential of American agriculture. If in some way, shape, or form the next administration is successful in deporting millions of people, and that is not going to be an easy task, and it's not going to be a task that can be done quickly, you're going to impact the available workforce in farm country, and you will impact what we can grow, how much of it we can grow, and how much of it we can harvest. That, in turn, could potentially put us in a situation where we become more reliant, not less reliant, on our own agricultural capacity, and we become more reliant on other countries for our food supply. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm concerned about that because I like the idea that we're a food-secure nation. And I like the idea that we have the capacity within our own means to be able to produce what it is we need.
Isn't there somehow the ag industry can adapt, readjust to get work done somehow without all the undocumented workers?
Well, there are certain aspects of agriculture that can be mechanized, but that increases the cost. And in increasing the cost, you essentially create a circumstance where you have to increase the cost of food. And then consumers begin to raise questions about whether or not food is as inexpensive as it needs to be.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This half hour, a conversation I had yesterday with U.S. Secretary of Agriculture and former Governor of Iowa, Tom Vilsack. We're going to take a short break and be back with Secretary Vilsack's thoughts on where the Democratic Party goes from here and his future after nearly 8 years as part of the Obama administration. Then we check in with University of Iowa Public Policy Director Pete Damiano about the future of Obamacare in Iowa under a President Trump. Back in just a moment with more River to River. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a few minutes, Pete Damiano will be along of the University of Iowa's Public Policy Center to tell us about the future of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, under a President Trump. But first, the rest of my conversation with U.S. Secretary of Agriculture and former Iowa Governor Tom Vilsack, recorded yesterday. On election night, Tom Vilsack, if you looked at the map, Iowa was a sea of red counties, only six counties voting for Hillary Clinton, six counties with Iowa's urban centers. So the question is, what can Democrats do to win back rural Iowa and rural America?
Well, it starts with making sure we're doing a better job educating people what government does and what it doesn't do. I think we have ceded that conversation for the last 30 years to those who believe that government's all about fraud, waste, and abuse. There's a lot of good that gets done every single day. 99% of what gets done is, you know, in my view, is positive. When we do a home loan for a family that could otherwise not get a home without government help, I think that's a good thing. When we provide an opportunity for a business to get a loan at a lower interest rate that they can allow them to expand or create new job opportunities, that's a good thing. We don't do enough of educating people about what we do. You know, governors do a great job of that. They're out every day telling people what they do, and so people sort of understand what happens at the state and local level. They don't understand very well what happens at the federal level, number one. Number two, the Democratic Party has to figure out a way to, how to talk to to folks in rural communities. And I think there is a way to talk to them about what we stand for that will be attractive to them. We just haven't done much of that. And I think you physically have to be there. You have to spend time in those rural communities. And, you know, one of the reasons why a Senator Grassley, for example, is successful isn't because necessarily that he's conservative. It's because every year he's in all 99 counties talking to folks. Governor Branstad has followed that same route. I know that I went to 99 counties when I was governor. You have to be there. I'd walk across the state. I'd go into those small towns, and I'd visit with people. They want to know that you're there. They want to know that you're thinking about them and working for them. Sometimes I think our party, my party, has a tendency not to do much of that. And finally, I think we have, within the Democratic Party, certainly created a lot of support for diverse groups. And we have messages that are very tailored and directed to diverse groups. But what we are lacking, I think, is a overarching message that if you're not one of these groups, that you can still identify with Democratic ideals and the Democratic vision for this country. So I think there's a lot of work that has to be done. And I think it starts not from the top down, but from the bottom up. And I think there's an awful lot of soul searching that's going to take place as a result of not just this election, but many, many elections in terms of governor's races, state legislative races, Senate and House races. Republicans have done a very, very good job of systematically getting their message in all parts of the country, which is results in them controlling state legislative bodies, controlling apportionment decisions, controlling congressional districts that are favorably inclined towards one party or another, winning more Senate seats and winning more governorships, and ultimately winning the presidency.
And finally, Tom Vilsack, what's next for you after finishing up 8 years as the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture? Heading back to Iowa, perhaps? Is there political life there? Running for governor in Iowa, perhaps?
Well, let me just start off by saying I don't know the answer to that question today, but what I do know is I've got four beautiful grandkids that I'd like to spend some time with and be close to. Three of them happen to be in Iowa. One of them happens to be in Colorado. And so that is certainly a consideration. Family is first and foremost a consideration. They've made a lot of sacrifices for the last 16 years in particular, the last 18 years in particular in my life, and it's time for me to sort of repay the family for the sacrifices they've made to me. I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm sure that I'll be busy and I'll be active, and hopefully I'll be able to use the information and the knowledge and some degree of wisdom that I've created by having this great job. This has been a fabulous job. It's a wonderful job.
Would you rule out a run for political office in the future, though?
Well, I wouldn't rule it out, but by not ruling it out, I don't want people to think I'm ruling it in, because, frankly, I think it's the next generation. We've got to look for new leadership, fresh leadership, younger. The next generation needs to step up now and take the reins. And so, that to me is where folks ought to be focused.
Okay. Thank you very much for being so generous with your time, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. Thank you.
You bet. Thank you.
That conversation with Secretary Vilsack recorded yesterday. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, took a step forward this week with Donald Trump's selection of House Budget Committee Chairman and six-term Georgia Representative Tom Price as the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. Price has been one of the most constant opponents of the ACA in Congress. He's also written perhaps the most comprehensive Republican alternative to the bill. Pete Damiano has joined us to explain changes in health care ever since the advent of the Affordable Care Act. He joins us now in the studio in Iowa City. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Ben.
Now, you've got some explaining to do about what may be the beginning of the end of Obamacare, what it means for us here in Iowa. You are director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. So tell us, first of all, the selection of Tom Price as HHS secretary, what does that tell you about the future of the ACA?
Well, first, I don't think Representative Price's selection is a surprise to anyone. He would be the type of person that a conservative president, let's just say, might look to. He has obviously been one of the more outspoken members of Congress and one of the most outspoken people in the country against the ACA. And so the mantra that was being used during the campaign and right after the election that we're going to repeal and replace right away. It makes sense that he would come in. There's obviously a lot of serious challenges to actually doing that, and we'll see where that actually how that plays out.
Okay, tell us a little bit about what the chief challenges in the how part of that repeal in place, repeal and replace. Is that actually going to happen? And if so, how would that happen in your view?
Well, you know, initially it was talked about as a full repeal and replace, and we're going to put in something, you know, really great. Then right after the election, there was sort of a little bit of backstepping and saying, well, there's certain aspects of it that I'd like to keep, like keeping children on their parents' policies to 26 and not take hurting people with pre-existing conditions. Now there's talk of actually something called repeal and transition rather than repeal and replace. Part of that is because of the congressional process right now, where Republicans don't have enough votes in the Senate, for example, that they can repeal by changing the rules, and they could do that right away, but the replace is going to take 60 votes, and there also isn't really a replacement plan anyways that's viable.
So they would want to, in short order, if they repealed something, replace it right away, or they have millions of previously uninsured, now insured people without anything.
Right. In Iowa, that would mean 50,000 people that have gotten health insurance through the exchanges would lose right now. Another 200,000 who are eligible for exchange coverage and haven't purchased it yet would lose that. On the Medicaid expansion side, you've got about 150,000 people that are a part of the Medicaid expansion and have engaged in insurance, and about another 60,000 that are eligible for coverage that would lose that. So in this repeal and transition, they're saying, well, we'll repeal it now, but with a sunset of 2 to 3 years that'll give us time to actually figure out how we're going to do that.
Mm-hmm. When we – and 2 to 3 years is a long ways away. There are many, many chapters in this book yet to come before this country settles on a health care insurance system. But it sounds like by what you're saying, we could well end up with an amalgamation, a mix of Obamacare's – cherry-pick some of Obamacare's parts and then have some new Republican ideas in here? Is that the way to think about it?
Well, it sort of seems that way. But if you go back to the beginning when the ACA was first being discussed, and, you know, it's called Obamacare as if the administration, you know, developed this. It was actually developed through the congressional process, and it was actually – most of it was written by the Senate Finance Committee, three Republicans, three Democrats, of which Senator Grassley and his staff were a part of that. And that's
– really?
Yeah, people forget that. And if you can look online and find discussions of Senator Grassley and Senator Baucus who were working together, drafted – the major portions of what became the ACA, and then it had to go through all its permutations, and there were some other things that happened. But ultimately, as we know, there weren't any Republicans that voted for it. It felt like the Democrats were ramming it down the Republicans' throat. But what that means is there are a lot of Republican ideas already incorporated in the ACA. So, for example, just the idea of the private health insurance exchanges, the healthcare.gov, was originally a conservative idea to keep private health insurance in the game as the expansion was going on so that you could get subsidized health insurance private instead of, you know, going toward a single payer or payment for all. It also levels the playing field because people with private who are buying an individual policy, for example, don't get it through their work. They don't get a tax subsidy, where everyone else that gets insurance through their employer gets to write it off their taxes to encourage employers to do it. So it's not – there's sort of this sense right now that we're giving people something that other people don't get, and it's actually much more of a leveling the playing field. So whether the exchanges stay the same or they morph a little bit – we just saw this in Kentucky, where the governor ran against the ACA, won, and gave up the state health insurance exchange to join healthcare.gov, the federal plan, which was a little ironic, but rather than throw the whole thing out. So there are a number of conservative aspects of the ACA and the state experimentation that's going on right now, the waivers that will probably be kept in some way.
Okay, what about the mandatory nature of the Affordable Care Act as it is now, that you must purchase health insurance? And we've heard one of the chief complaints, hey, I'm in my 20s, I'm healthy, I have no reason to believe I'll ever be sick. Why do I need health insurance?
Right, and that's probably the thing that people hate the most and misunderstand the most, but just nobody likes this idea that they're being forced to do something.
Right.
You know, it feels un-American.
Right.
But that was because to get the private insurance companies to say, we're going to get rid of pre-existing conditions and annual maximums and won't drop you if you get sick, they said, but you've got to bring everybody in so that the risk pool is more balanced. If it's just the sick people that buy insurance, and that's the problem with high-risk pools and why they haven't worked, is because you're grouping the sickest people together and the cost becomes so high no matter how much you subsidize it. And there's also sort of a conservative component to that, that everybody should be pulling their weight and that everyone should have insurance coverage so that there's this uncompensated care from the people that get care and aren't covered that everyone has to pay for should go away. We all should have to come in and carry our weight.
Mm-hmm. So a picture that I'm getting, and tell me how accurate this might be to simplify it. This is a very complicated area. So would it be, without the mandatory nature of it, would it be a little bit like not wanting to purchase homeowners insurance until the corner of your house is on fire?
Right. I mean, that's pretty much it. Or the reverse of that is that if you buy insurance, that your house is more likely to be on fire. I mean, with health insurance, we do know when you buy insurance, you are more likely to use it. But both sort of speak to that it's not insurance in the traditional sense. Mm-hmm. It's a social good. We're prepaying for care. We cover preventive services, which is not something you do with insurance generally, because we want people to use it. Mm-hmm. Be healthier, hold down costs later, all those kinds of things.
So now I'm getting a picture that it may be really the struggle that's to come in the months and years is a matter of branding, that Republicans might want to keep a lot of the things that are presently enjoyed by Americans previously uninsured, but new packaging and certainly not let Obama take credit for it? Am I being too off the, I don't know, chart with that?
Well, there will definitely be a dance going on. So if you say we're going to repeal now and come up with a plan in 3 years, part of what they're saying the Republicans also want to do is put pressure on the Democrats, because they're going to say, okay, you either come and work with us or you're going to be the ones that are going to be partially responsible for this whole thing failing.
Right.
And so, and then what that means and how those negotiations will go on, you know, regardless of what was said during the campaign, it's going to come down to what happens during the congressional process. And you're getting into the weeds a little bit, but which congressional committees in the Senate and the House are responsible for different parts of jurisdiction, the tax part versus the insurance part, things like that. Who are the chairs of these groups? How do they work together with each other across the House and the Senate? You know, it's not like Paul Ryan's plan is all of a sudden just going to get rammed through. You know, that's what happened the last time. It was the Senate plan that basically got rammed down the throat of the Democrats in the House. And Nancy Pelosi got them to vote for it with the promise that they were going to change things later, and that never happened because nobody wanted to touch the ACA again.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be an interesting dance just between the House and the Senate Republicans, let alone with the Democrats, to try to get to the 60 votes in the Senate.
About 5 minutes left with Pete Damiano, director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. We like to turn to Pete as the chapters unfold in the story of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, which has been since 2009, 2010, and continues with an exciting new chapter. We'll just say it that way. And let's talk about the Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act, and also the selection by Donald Trump of the Indiana health policy consultant Seema Verma to run the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Tell us about those aspects.
So I do not know her personally, but I have talked to some people that have worked with her here in Iowa. She's worked with both the previous Medicaid director and the current Medicaid director on, first, the waiver that was put in for the health and wellness plan that allowed at that time people to purchase private insurance through the marketplace. That's no longer there because of the managed care component of Medicaid. And then also going through with the managed care piece. And they say she's very bright, knows these things inside and out in terms of Medicaid waivers. So as the head of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, she's going to come in with a lot of expertise. She also has a very conservative perspective, as you might expect, about having members pay some sort of a premium, some healthy behavior component to it, or something like that, some personal responsibility aspect that will probably get worked into this. Also a sense that even though there are a lot of state experimentation going on right now, making the waivers easier for the states to do, not have reporting requirements as much. But the trade-off, of course, is that you have less accountability, that we're going to be giving money to the states with fewer strings attached, which the states will like, but to make sure the money is spent well, that won't be there as much as is happening currently.
Mm-hmm. So Medicaid, the health program for low-income Americans, low-income Iowans, for instance, I think more than 500,000 recipients of Medicaid in Iowa currently. We've just gone through moving the management of that to a private company. So I think three private companies. How does that work now with the new outlook for the Affordable Care Act, or right, what's to come after that?
Well, Iowa was a part of a wave of many states moving towards managed care in their Medicaid programs, both Republican and Democratic states. So I don't think that will change. One thing that Iowa did that was different was putting the whole program in relatively quickly. That's, to my knowledge, we were the first state to do it in that way. Because of the interest in privatization of a lot of things, I don't think that will go away. But what will be, if the Medicaid expansion goes away and the 150,000 people that are a part of that are no longer in the risk pool and that will be eligible by these three managed care plans to be members, it's not clear if that will make it less attractive. And then there was a report that just came out in the Des Moines Register this morning about how the plans are losing, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars right now in the first 9 months, and what that will mean just for the cost and when they come back to renegotiate, you know, whatever their rate setting is, and if the Medicaid expansion were to go away, how that would affect the rate setting as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand your public policy center at the University of Iowa is evaluating the ACA expansion. So what points are you looking at specifically?
So we're looking at everything from the cost aspect of it, and not with the managed care part as much as with the Medicaid expansion and the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan, as well as the impact on the consumers and the healthy behavior incentives component of that. There's also a couple of programs that predate the ACA a little bit but are sort of weaved together, the Integrated Health Home for people with severe and persistent mental illness. There was a carve-out to a company called Magellan to handle mental health before, but then an effort to control the health care for people with chronic health problems as well. So we're looking at all of those things.
Mm-hmm. We haven't talked a lot about the delivery side of healthcare services. What can we say about that, where it is now and forecast a little bit in the future under right, the new circumstances?
Yeah, that's a great point, Ben. We focus so much on the insurance coverage, which is really important, but the changes that are happening in the healthcare delivery side are very rapid and very, very significant. The formation of what are called accountable care organizations, which allows hospitals and health systems to work together in a way that they haven't been able to before, and moving the payment towards something called value-based purchasing or bundled payments instead of what's traditionally been called fee-for-service, and the idea of trying to get more value and have some outcomes that are associated with the costs. That I don't think will change that much, because that's something that there's sort of a cross-the-aisle belief that we need to move toward. There's a big entity within CMS called the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, CMMI. It isn't clear if that will stay. That's been targeted by some, but I think probably at least some of what they're doing, it gives money to the states primarily and others to experiment with new ideas. You know, it'll be interesting to kind of, again, see how that plays out.
Mm-hmm. A lot of concerned people, I'm sure, listening to this conversation, your words, Pete Damiano, where should concerned people turn to with their questions? Because watching the news may rise, give you a lot of anxiety, but not a lot of means to find out if it's going to affect you or how it's going to affect you.
Right. I mean, from a national perspective, there's two what I think are really good organizations that have great online information, the Commonwealth Fund and the Kaiser Family Foundation. They've got very good, pretty unbiased information about what the implications of the ACA were before and then the changes that will be coming up. I think locally, it's really important but hard to do is try to tease out the important components. So like when you ask people about the ACA or the changes, covering kids up to age 26, do you like it? Yes. Getting rid of pre-existing? Yes. Do you like Obamacare? No, I hate it. Well, you're starting to see the poll numbers already begin to change on those things, and it's like, you know, go careful on this repeal. And so it'll be interesting to see, but try to really focus on the issues as much and get away from the rhetoric, but it's hard.
Just a few seconds left. So it sounds like you'll be anticipating, perhaps watching for sort of further moderating of Republican positions on the repeal and replace mantra.
Well, it'll as things go through the congressional process, and you've got the debate going on, as I said, between the House and the Senate Republicans, as well as with the Democrats on both sides, where things go. And it gets very, very complex. And it's going to be really important to follow that detail and hopefully have the kind of dialogue we need to end up with in a good place.
We are sure glad you're here to hold our hand and take us through the many chapters of Obamacare health care. Pete Damiano, director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming into our studio, Pete.
Thank you, Ben.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow, it's a News Buzz edition. I hope you'll tune in for that. Thanks for joining us.